Welcome to Film Fight Club, the show where we don't talk about film, we fight about film. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by local filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hello, hello.
Freelancer, writer, and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest this week, Richard Gray from website The Real Bits. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a great show planned. We're talking Netflix. We're talking Roger Moore, who sadly passed away yesterday. But first, we will be talking about the film of the week, which is Viceroy's House. Now, this is a film that played at the Berlinale. It played at the Young at Heart Film Festival at Palace Cinemas, and it's in Palace Cinemas now. It is set in 1947 during the partition, and it is starring Hugh Bonneville and Gillian Anderson, and is about a British Indian co-production about what went on in this period. A few of us have seen it, and Virat, what did you reckon about Viceroy's House?
Well, where should I begin? Gosh, let me flag this first. Let's not expect any historical accuracy in the film. It's not a historical drama. Yes, it is set during the time of the partition, but it is nothing about that. It is not about that. And it's directed by Gurinder Chadha, who made Bend It Like Beckham, a great film an eternity ago, when Keira Knightley was still not a thing. But now she is a thing. But sadly, the director hasn't moved on. So that is a problem there. But unfortunately, what really, really hurt me was, yes, this is a serious topic. You know, there is a heavy heart when you talk about partition, and there's a lot of emotional drama that could be mined from this film. But instead, this film becomes a very pantomime-esque sort of, as Richard would say, colonial cosplay.
Yes.
I'm sorry I'm hijacking your term here.
Damn, that was my only line. Much like Pamela Mountbatten.
Not a lot of love here for this film.
Look, I complete with everything that Virat said. It was the problem with this film is that it puts the Mountbattens at the center of this thing, and it has this upstairs downstairs view of history. But the problem with that approach is that it just ignores everything that they actually did. Like, it's almost divorces the Mountbattens from any responsibility for this. It kind of puts the blame fairly on Britain. The Mountbattens came out squeaky clean as a result of it. They seem to be just, you know, Lady Mountbatten comes off as someone who's is a human rights crusader who just happened to find herself in India at the time.
Gosh. You know. But what the problem with that is, it feels like it's basically Downton Abbey.
Yes.
Yeah, but on a very weird kind of drug episode.
You know, a very special episode.
Drug adult episode of Downton Abbey. Because
I'd watch that episode.
I would watch that too. Like, that sounds like great television.
I think we're doing a bad job of talking about this film because we're actually selling the film, which is not a good thing. But the problem with the film is the way it presents, and this dichotomy between the British characters and the Indian characters. And there is a huge power dynamic which is at play. And the first shot that we see of the film are Indian people cleaning up the floors, cleaning up the Viceroy's house, trying to make it squeaky clean. And that sort of feudal mentality doesn't go away. And it tries to project as if the colonial enterprise was this benevolent British enterprise and it just went wrong. Oops, sorry.
Yeah, we'll leave quietly now.
Yeah. But it's
sorry
not
about the mess, old chaps. We'll see ourselves out.
But that's a real problem because for a long time, ever since colonial history, the horrors of colonialism have been trying watered down for a long time. And I think people kind of getting sick of that. We need to revisit colonial history and try to present it as accurately as we can. And it's not about historical accuracy, even though the way it presents Indian sort of diplomats at the time, you know, Nehru, as I can say, because, hey, we're at Nehru. And if you can make that connection, don't make a connection. Don't tell me about that. Anyway, the actual Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, and the other Indian leaders at the time, the way it presents them, for example, the way it presented Gandhi, was a really weird caricature. And
how do you get Gandhi wrong?
Yeah.
Like, how do you get him? And I mean, they
how
did.
You had one job.
Like, everybody has a picture of Gandhi. Like, even people who've never met the guy already know what he looks like, and they still got it wrong. I'm like, how? And he's played by a brilliant actor, Neeraj Kabbi, he was in Ship of Theseus, and he's a very good Indian actor, and he was reduced. I don't know what he was doing in that film.
Well, can I ask, there's also a romantic subplot in this movie, entirely separate from the main narrative.
Yes, this is like Chocolat set in the partition India time. I
think you're being generous.
Like, like I actually like chocolat. So.
Johnny Depp's a theme tonight, I think.
Yes, there's a lot of Johnny Depp that's going to be happening tonight.
Yeah, but it's, I don't know what is going on, because, and what really hurts me also is the director, Gurinder Chadha, made this film with a lot of sincerity, what it seems, because she's dedicating this film to her own past. It's a way of her trying to rediscover her roots and going back to that idea. And this is her dedication to her trying to work out where she's come from. So in a way, it feels like a sincere film, but it's not.
It's strange because Gillian Anderson is doing such good projects like The Fall, The X-Files Arrival, but this just seems to be a bit of a misstep.
I mean, she's pretty good in it. The problem is that her character, there's a lot of, as Virat said, there's a lot of historical inaccuracies. It completely ignores her relationship with the Indian Prime Minister.
I mean, that's a film I would watch. I mean, honestly, the misdemeanors of Edmina Mountbatten.
I mean, for those who aren't in the know, she had a very notorious affair with, you know.
None of that is in the film.
Not even a hint of it.
Not even a hint of it.
Oh, this doesn't.
I know. As someone who has like a personal interest in that story, I was very disappointed. Mm.
Oh, it doesn't sound like best reviews.
But even like I mean, dropping the jokes for a second, this movie has the late Om Puri, who passed away recently, one of his last roles. And I'm just saddened to know that this is the way we might remember him, as a plot device, because he just reduced to that really sad, blind father role that nobody wants him to play.
Oh, well, that's Viceroy's House. It's in cinemas now.
Go see it.
Yes, not a lot of divided opinion on this one, but we will be back very shortly after a quick break, and we will be talking all things Netflix. Stay tuned.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and a venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18. You can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
And we're back on Film Fight Club, and we are talking all things Netflix. Now, and whether Netflix films and films without a traditional theatrical release should qualify for awards ceremonies and festivals. There's been a lot of contention recently with the Cannes Film Festival, who've recently restated that in the coming years, there has to be at least a small theatrical release. This is by no means not a controversy in Australia. Okja, which also screened to some contention at the Cannes Film Festival, which will be opening on Netflix in the coming weeks, will close the Sydney Film Festival this year. And there's a big debate about whether these are the correct rules or what is happening with the cinema. Netflix is certainly changing the cinema landscape. And what is the change in the entire shift in the theatrical release schedule and how things are done mean for cinema going forward? Richard?
Look, I mean, just as I was coming into this, I happened to be reading an article on IndieWire who were talking about the changing nature of cinema, and that cinema is changing dramatically, and it's not one thing anymore. And the recognition is that a millennial audience, if I can use the term millennial.
Sure.
Why not?
Shout out listeners.
a younger audience is growing up in an environment where screens are getting smaller and content is getting more easily accessible. So the rationale is that why not have first run movies on your phone or on your computer screen or what have you? And let's be fair, it's not just Netflix. We're talking about other big distributors like Amazon as well, who massive behemoths who sort of seem to own the technology sector now. First, they were disrupting the technology sector, and now they're disrupting the theatrical sector as well. So we've got these two things happening, but I think the real question behind this is, what is cinema, almost, in a way?
Right, that's definitely true. The question could be raised, if something's premiering on Netflix, is it a TV movie? Because Netflix is now most commonly associated with TV shows.
Yeah.
And this is appearing on that channel. It doesn't have a theatrical release to set it aside. And it's not given the kind of grand rollout that films released in a theater get. Netflix don't seem to be taking any effort to give their original films a level of prestige that they might have received if they'd been given a theatrical release. Amazon, on the other hand, are pushing their films in cinemas. For example, Manchester by the Sea,
that's
which
true.
Made a yeah. big splash. But Netflix...
Also a good film, The Big Big Splash.
Yes.
Yes.
A Bigger Splash.
Sorry, Bigger Splash.
That's also a good film.
Yes.
But,
it's even better than Big Splash. It's bigger.
But you can say that the times are moving away from the big screen cinema experience, yeah. and that's a less relevant thing to a lot of people in the younger generation. But I think the issue that the Khan, a lot of naysayers of Netflix who've been pressuring Khan not to screen the films, I think a big part of their issue is that Netflix are in many ways undervaluing their films.
Yeah.
And the movie watching, if not theatrical yeah. experience.
I mean, I agree. Yeah.
At the same time, let's see where the Khan people are. It's a French Riviera, I mean, yeah. honestly,
it's beautiful,
we're not.
Man.
We're not. I mean, I accept it. It's beautiful, but we're not all there. I'm here in Sydney in a studio with you guys.
Yeah,
well, it's not exactly the French Riviera.
Thanks,
and
man.
I also,
So we're not taking you to Khan next year.
darn, that was my only option. But at the same time, I also need my access to films. I need my film fix. You know, yeah. I need my hit. How do I get it?
Yeah, because the theatrical environment isn't catering to the art house audience in Sydney as much as it did even 10 years ago now.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's the bigger issue. I mean, it's kind of, we're in a bit of a bubble here in Australia. We haven't, I mean, traditionally when I was younger, it took months even for the bigger releases to make their way out here. And now it's a very different environment. We get day-and-day releases. Sometimes we get them earlier.
We're looking at you, John Wick.
Right, and that's a really great example. There is no reason in my mind that some of these films... I know we have a limited number of screens here, but there's no reason in my mind that if there's an audience for something, it can't be released here
in
some format.
Yeah, because John Wick did really well in Australia.
It did really well.
And he never got a release. Like, what, John Wick 2, what happened there?
I know, and it's the weirdest thing. I mean, a whole bunch of them have happened lately. 20th Century Women was one this week as well. It just came out.
Notably from the same distributor as John Wick 2.
Right.
These guys do not care.
Well, I mean, the thing is, look, going back to Netflix, I mean, this is changing the cinema landscape in a lot of ways because they are trying to bring back the mid-budget movie. And War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, opens this week, and it's nothing to sneeze at. There's a TV film, potentially.
From the director of... Yeah, Animal Kingdom and The Rover.
Yeah, one of the biggest stars in the world, Tilda Swinton, Ben Kingsley. It's huge.
Actually, when you were on that, the term TV movie really irks me because it sort of implies a hierarchy or a dichotomy which I don't think exists anymore.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, it's true.
But Netflix, it's interesting though, because in the way that Netflix markets or doesn't market these films, you have things that are pretty tantamount to what we used to consider a TV movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's
except
what I'm saying.
It stars Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
Up against a Martin Scorsese movie, and they'll get the same marketing.
The Ridiculous Six was ridiculously good.
Big Vanilla was Mark Twain. I mean, come on. Yeah.
Sandy Wexler, I love you.
Yeah. I mean, if you're being generous, you could say that Netflix is, you know, democratizing film. Like, you know, all films are out there on an equal landscape. They're easily, there's an all-you-can-eat model that you can access them all anytime you want. But I watch every Netflix original film. I watch all the Netflix original indies, and Netflix doesn't promote those anymore in my allegedly curated feed than I don't know, that, as you said, the new Adam Sandler, the, you know, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, any of those things, which is fantastic, but still it's these are the things that float to the surface. And there was great I don't feel at home in this world anymore was a Sundance film that went straight to Netflix within a month, I think, of Sundance.
I think also the new Jeremy Sonnier film, follow-up to Green Room, will also be on Netflix.
Yes. Joe Swanberg's film, I think it was called... I've forgotten the name of it for a moment, but it went straight from South by Southwest. So Win It All was the name of it.
Yes.
Straight from South by Southwest within a few months to Netflix as well. How many people know that?
Yeah.
You know?
The thing... Okay, I understand where a lot of the traditionalists at Khan are coming from, in that they view this as a threat to the way things have been and to the glory of witnessing a movie with a crowd of strangers on a big, huge screen with great sound in the dark. But are the people who are catering to that old model, as you say, Richard, producing the mid-budget film? Would Okja exist if not for Netflix? Who is giving $50 million to a crazy Korean action auteur to make a nuts, vegetarian, horror, monster, adventure?
Exactly.
Thing.
And let's face it, the majority of people, sorry to interrupt, but the majority of people who are going to see that film, it is playing at the Sydney Film Festival. There's at least two screenings of it happening.
Yes.
And I would say there's a huge chunk of the Sydney population who are interested in that film who were already bought tickets to that film.
Absolutely, I've got my tickets. Know. But this is the thing, and we were talking about seeing it in a crowd, and that's fantastic, but at the same time, there is something to seeing a film, particularly a film that's made for a big screen, on a big screen. And this is why so many people are excited to see Oxygen in that format. And is the new way, is the new way this is going necessarily taking away from that or moving in the direction a lot of big IMAX, huge screen filmmakers don't want to go?
I think we who love that experience are a dying breed. And, well, we shouldn't...
I hope not. I mean, I'd like to live for a few more years before I pass away.
But I think the theatrical distributors and the even more than that, the production companies have themselves to blame for a large part of this because in the content that they're pushing and the market, the... marketing strategies they've pursued, they've really devalued the theatrical experience themselves.
Yeah.
So to a lot of people, the theatrical experience doesn't necessarily have this level of prestige because it's associated with just CGI spectacles and date movies and 3D.
I think genre cinema has now become so permeated with what you go out and see in the theater that artistic integrity and the aesthetic experience of seeing something at the big screen is now almost extinct.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I mean, movies, I mean, look, let's face it. A few of us in this room certainly have a rarefied experience in that we do get a lot of distributor screenings for free.
Yes.
So we see a lot of movies that other people... I've been to media screenings for films which I don't... I think the entire audience of that cinema was in that room. You know, because it may not have gotten a Sydney release. Like you know?
We don't talk about Viceroy's House again, are we?
Possibly.
That has every old lady in Sydney up around the block.
But the point is, like, movies are expensive to go and see. And, you know, you can't go and see every independent film. And the one thing that I will give digital distribution props for is the same thing that home media did a while ago, direct to video movies, direct to DVD movies, exactly the same question, except now we're actually in a position where the streaming has such a huge audience because people already subscribe to Netflix, people already subscribe to Amazon. They don't have to do anything extra to get the content.
That's exactly right. Know. Humans are a species of convenience, aren't they? But a lot of the time, what we're trading... convenience for quality. I really miss video stores. The level of selection you had in terms, you know, for a cinephile was amazing to be able to hunt out old films, foreign films, classic films.
Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2.
Exactly.
That.
Even just in your local suburban video store, they had a selection that shames Netflix.
My local
video
store.
They're not sticking up for cinema.
My local video store was one of the big, you know, Blockbuster or one of the large chains. But the person who ran it curated the hell out of that.
Yeah.
And he loved doing that. And so it had one of the best art house collections of any major video store. And that's why I discovered half my love of cinema from that one.
No, it's incredible. I mean, I remember my video store very fondly growing up, Video Easy. It shut down. Now it's a nice cafe. But, you know, Netflix still hasn't recreated the experience of flipping through that literally thousands of DVDs and VCRs that was back then. So we're going to go to a quick break, and we're going to be back talking about our best bad movie segment. Stay tuned.
I guess I'll have to change my plan.
On May 27, you may well have to change your plans if you don't want to miss the 2SER Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon. 2SER's celebration of all things Bob will go for 8 hours and feature news, reviews, interviews, the Bob Dylan quiz, and all the Bob songs that fit, starting at 8 p.m. and going through till 4 in the morning. The Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon on 2SER, May 27, from 8 p.m. 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music, and Bob. It's a hard rain's
gonna fall. And we're back on Film Fight Club with a segment we're very excited about called the Best Bad Movie Segment. Now, this is where we're all critics and we get to pick Not after this one. And we each, every now and then, one of us gets to pick a film that we loved and that we adored but was panned and pilloried by everyone else there. And this week it is Virat's turn. Virat, what is your movie?
Okay, my movie is... Brace yourselves, guys. It is Tim Burton's, yes, Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Whoa.
Not Gene Wilder version, the Johnny Depp version, which...
I was convinced you were going to go for Dark Shadows right then.
That would be interesting, well, radio.
That would be
okay,
fascinating.
That was my number two pick, right. But it's all right. But that's because I love Tim Burton, but...
Do you love Dark Shadows?
I do love Dark Shadows.
That is interesting.
Wow. Okay, guys, take it easy.
It's next week.
All right. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I thought I was in the right because when it released, as I checked the Wikipedia page, it was released to critical appraisal, and I was like, yes! But
did Tim Burton write that?
Yeah.
Over time, yeah, it's come to be quite disliked.
That is true. And over time, I've liked it more and more. It's one of those things that I've tried not to admit in public.
So why do you love it?
Yeah. Why do I love it? I think there's something very innocuous about Burton's approach towards filmmaking that it's becoming lost. And I think that's one of the things that I really do appreciate about Burton. You know, not only from his early filmography, there's a consistency in Burton's approach to his filmmaking that I can basically trace back to his earlier films. So, and he retains that in his version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And also, I kind of like the cookie Willy Wonka. For some reason,
it's Michael Jackson.
A very radical reimagining of it. And it's nothing like we ever imagined. I mean, Willy Wonka as a character itself was quite radical. But this is an even radical version of that. And over time, I'm like, yeah, I kind of dig it. I don't know why. I just do.
I felt Johnny Depp was just phoning it in then. I mean, he's made a few not so great ones over the past few years.
I mean, Johnny Depp has been phony ever since he did Jack Sparrow, Pirates of the Caribbean.
That was a fantastic performance, though. But
that's the beginning of the phoniness of the Deppness.
Was that the turning point? I mean, Johnny Depp is you know, ironically playing the Invisible Man now in the Universal Dark Universe films, I feel as though that's what he has been to audiences for, you know, a couple of years now. But
he overplayed a shtick and people got sick of it, I think.
What was the point? Because I remember there was a movie called Transcendence.
Oh, yes.
And that was a phoned-in performance. I'm just driving this thing through a computer or something.
It was just CGI Johnny Depp for most of the film.
Yeah.
To take on this challenge, rewatched Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for the first time since it was released yesterday.
Okay. I don't pity you.
I'm sorry, I have to say this, Chris. I do love you.
Yeah, it's okay.
You know, it's okay.
We'll get through this.
Fight Club.
All right. I went in expecting to hate it after being warned by everybody when I said that I wanted to rewatch it. But, you know, it's a mixed bag, actually. I thought the first half an hour of this movie is wonderful. I agree that it's very consistent with what Burton's always been doing. Beautiful compositions and beautiful production design. The house that's slanted on the side, it's really something to behold. And the tone is just right.
Yeah.
The voiceover and the music and the performance of
really
his elderly
cool.
family. Yeah, it's fantastic.
But that whole subplot of the family with Christopher Lee, it just wasn't necessary.
Yeah, the thing about, I agree that feels tacked on. I think the problem for me is that it feels like two different movies. And the second one isn't nearly as interesting as the first because it's constantly hitting on the same note of these are grotesque kids and they get knocked out by Willy Wonka's slasher movie Candy House.
Yes, there is something to be said that Burton has been trying to remake the same gothic teen angsty teenager movie for every teenager since eternity. But I think there is something very real about that because most of Burton's characters, the main characters, are these sort of misfits who don't find their place. Yeah. And he's trying to sort of put that in a very family model and trying them to find their place.
I just wish that Burton had held on to that emotional core throughout the film because when I feel it goes into the factory and, as I said, starts to enter into this monotonous kind of structure, basically Charlie and his grandfather, who've been the heart of the film for the introduction, then just have to sit still and be silent while they watch Tim Burton, a.k.a. Willy Wonka, show off his machines.
Yeah, but also,
and
at the same time...
the end of the film suddenly tries to inject this emotional family core, which they've forgotten about for over an hour, back in with Willy Wonka's father, which hasn't really been integrated into the narrative.
I'm just thinking I need to rewatch this film because I haven't seen it in quite some time. I agree with you. One of the things that I do like about Tim Burton is that aesthetic line that you can draw straight back. I've always liked that. And I do. It's something that I actually like. And I think one of the films that most disappointed me was Planet of the Apes because you couldn't see that in there.
Yes, okay. Yeah,
however, I think that's also the generous approach to Tim Burton who... who you can also say has been doing the same thing over and over again. We've seen that. And I mentioned Dark Shadows at the top. And I think that's when it goes too far. I haven't seen it for a while, but I do remember thinking at the time it was a step too far, because the original one, or the original, the Gene Wilder version is so dear to me. And to me, that's a performance that's really hard to top.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm. No, it's... well, there will be many more Best Bad Movie segments in the coming weeks, but for the moment, we want to take a few minutes to talk about Sir Roger Moore, who...
Yes.
Yes, who sadly passed away at the age of 89 following a battle with cancer yesterday. He played James Bond in a record 7 films. No other actors played him that much. He played him from 73 through to 85. He was the campiest and the suavest of James Bonds. When asked if he did all his own stunts, he responded, "Yes, I did all my own stunts. I also do all my own lying." And he was quite spectacular. And he made a lot of great James Bond films. My personal favorite, we'll get to talk about our own, was not my favorite, but one I feel is underappreciated, was A View to a Kill. This is a film where at the age of 58, he took on Christopher Walken, a blimp, the Golden Gate Bridge, hung off the side of a fire truck, drove a car onto a bus, proved he was a champion equestrian, and snowboarded to the tune of California Girls in one of the best opening sequences of any of the films. And there was also Grace Jones and all this other stuff. And oh yes, he will be missed.
Yes. Oh my God, Roger Moore, Roger Moore. And talking of Roger Moore, actually, Australia has paid his own tribute to Roger Moore by a new hashtag. Bond was Australian.
Bond was Australian once.
Yeah. I mean, once. we don't talk about
There's
that.
There's a new film about that, by the way.
Yeah, Becoming Bond by, you know, with George Lazenby. But the hashtag, some of my favorite ones, you know, about the man with the golden gay time. It's one of my favorite Australian references.
Roger Moore was a pretty interesting Bond in how he pushed the series into being so comedic, so campy. With that in mind, I have to pay my respects to Moonraker, which in its glorious silliness...
Coming in for re-entry.
Exactly. He pushed the pun thing to another level.
Yeah.
That movie was just... completely unapologetic about what glorious trash it was, and 6-year-old me loved it and still holds on to some of that love today.
Take a giant leap for mankind.
Well, talking of giant leaps, I loved Live and Let Die because he leapt on top of crocodiles in that film. And, wow. And that was when he did that, I was like, is that happening? And that's one of my favorite memories from childhood, when he actually tiptoed on top of crocodiles and crossed a pond.
And never broke a sweat. In that film, broke a world record with the boat jump.
Yes. Yeah. So, and great soundtrack. One of my best Bond movie soundtracks.
Paul McCartney and Wings.
Yep.
Oh, look, I do have a deep soft spot for Live and Let Die, mostly because of the theme, but it has to be The Spy Who Loved Me. Because there are two key scenes in that. One of them is the ski parachute thing, where he skis and then parachutes off a mountain. You can't... I mean, that's one of the best Bond stunts, full stop. But see, it's got the underwater car. It's got the infamous underwater Lotus Esprit, which is was a crazy car to start with. It's beautiful. But the car was called Wet Nelly, which... incidentally, is my rapper name.
And talking with Spy Who Loved Me, the very, very obvious undercurrent of love between the US and Russia right now.
Yes.
So I think it might be back in vogue.
I think the next Bond film is going to have a whole different flavor.
What about The Man with the Golden Gun? Scaramanga, the duel against his equal? One of the classics.
I always find it disappointing because it reduced Brig Eklund, who is a wonderful actress, to... being in a cupboard, which is pretty sad.
True. But he made a few others. For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy.
And yes, the...
Man, I must have seen that twice.
but more than, I think, Blofeld, what I think the most formidable opponent for Bond was Jaws, Richard Kiel. And that was Roger Moore and Richard Kiel. That's who you associate when you think of Bond.
And they became friends in the end. And they had the classic scene on the cable car. Still one of the best action sequences where he jumps to the other. That's all we have time for. We will miss you, Roger Moore. I will be rewatching Moonraker later tonight. In the meantime, Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
As you can see, Richard's writings on therealbits.com. And we will be back next week talking everything Sydney Film Festival. It's only 2 weeks away. It's very exciting, with the Sydney Film Festival director, Nashan Moodley.
I'm excited, yeah.
Now that'll be pretty good.
It'll be
great. So in the meantime, enjoy movies, have a wonderful night, and...
have your martinis shaken, not stirred.
Good night.
Night all.